Hello and welcome. I'm excited to announce that I've just released my first ebook and it's completely free just for you. And I guarantee if you love this show, you'll love this book. So go check it out after you finish listening at lukegreenhart.com/free. Hello and welcome to the Selfish Podcast. In today's episode, we have ML Farrell. And I'm really excited and interested to get to know her and hear her story. So welcome. And can you just tell me, where in the world are you and what time of day is it for you?
So first, thank you so much for having me on. I've been really excited about this for a while. I am in Indianapolis, Indiana, and it's about 9:15 here, give or take a few minutes in the morning.
9:15. I'm always so curious to know where my guests are from and even the audience, because it's such a beautiful time to be able to connect in an instant. I'm in the south of Spain at the moment and it is 3 p.m. for me and a rainy day.
I love it. So, you know, it's funny because when you sent me the link to schedule the interview, it was like 1 to 2 p.m. UTC. And I was like, what does that mean? So then I had to Google it to figure out what time it was going to be here. And I was like, oh, that's 9 a.m. Let me make sure I set an alarm so I can be responsible and actually get up, because I had no idea.
Interesting, because it's meant to be automatic to wherever the person from. It will give them it in their time zone. So it's very interesting that it didn't come up that way for you.
So it did. It sent me something that says like 9 a.m. Eastern Standard. But then when it sent me the notification and it added it to my calendar, it added it as 1 p.m. So then I had to go back and figure out why did it add it like that. And then that's when I Googled to see what UTC meant. So when you schedule, it says, you know, whatever your time zone is. But then when you get ready to add it to your calendar, it says something different. And so I had to make sure that I checked so that all of my calendars matched.
Yeah, well, it's so funny because I had for the first time that same issue today. I was just talking to my love Danielle and I said, oh, I will start setting up some food and bits, because I said, oh, I've got a podcast at 4 o'clock for me, which is in like an hour from now. And then I saw a notification on my phone saying your podcast is in 5 minutes. And I was like, no, it's 4 o'clock. And when I looked at my calendar said 4. And then on my emails, it said 3. And I was like, and I think I just messaged you, so maybe 5 minutes late. I wasn't expecting it to be now. It's like, I'm not sure what that is, where it's really handy that it puts it in your calendar, but it's not so effective when it puts the wrong time.
Yeah, I figured that I had to go into my calendar, my actual calendar settings.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that on mine too. With my guests, I really like to get to know them on a more personal and intimate level. And I like to know about the beginning of their lives. So can you paint me a picture of what your childhood was like where you grew up, what your parents did, and yeah, how life was for you as a child, say pre 10 years old?
Oh, life for me as a child was very traumatic, actually. So I am a cancer survivor, and my book, How Much Can I See, is actually a detailed depiction of my life up until now. So all the parts I can remember of my life leading up until where we are today. And it's crazy. You know, when I was about 5 years old, I went to live with my mother, not by choice, but by necessity. My mom was going to nursing school, and my aunt actually was living with my mom at the time. And from my understanding of the story, my aunt was pregnant and she needed a little more help with her third child. So while my mom was in nursing school, I went to live with my grandfather. My eldest brother went to live with my mom's older brother, and my youngest brother went to live with his dad. And in the beginning, it was like, okay, you know, I was really traumatized because I was young, but as children, we adapt. So that wasn't, you know, going to be so much the issue. The issue came because not long after I started living with my grandfather, I started feeling very, very sick. And I would tell my grandfather, like, something is wrong with me. I don't feel good. You know, and I was five. So it was like my belly hurts, you know, that kind of stuff that comes from a small child. And so my grandfather believed that I was faking, you know. And I remember even as a young person overhearing him say one time, like, oh, well, she's just trying to deal with the trauma of her, of having to come live here. So she's going to say whatever she's going to say to make her, you know, get some attention or something like that. And I remember my mother getting mad about that because she was like, she's a five-year-old, you know, she doesn't have the capacity to make up an elaborate lie. And it wasn't until one day our school nurse, I was really, really sick and I got sent to the nurse's office and I had a fever over 100. And our school nurse called my grandfather, and I remember my grandfather being really angry that he had to pick me up from school. And the school nurse was like, look, this is not the first time, even this week, that she's been in the office complaining of not feeling well, but she's got a temperature over 100. Like, something's wrong with this kid. And so my grandfather takes me home, you know, back to the house. He gives me some medicine and stuff. And a few hours later, I wake up and I still have a fever over 100. And I end up going to the emergency room. And when I get to the emergency room, they, you know, ran some tests or whatever. And then they said, oh, well, she's got appendicitis. It's common in kids this young for her to have something like that. So they go and they plan to rush me into surgery. And they get me into surgery and they found a tumor attached to my appendix and the exterior lining of my stomach. And they determined that the tumor was cancerous. And I was in a very small town in Indiana. So that hospital, the local hospital, didn't have what they would have needed to treat me. So they said, well, why don't we send you to Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis and they can give you the treatment that you need. So a few days after I went to the hospital to get what we thought was a simple appendectomy, I was in Indianapolis at Riley Children's Hospital getting all kinds of tests and things done and finding out that I had cancer. And for a large part of my life, like those first few years, I was living at the hospital. We would drive up. Sometimes it would be like on a Sunday and I would stay there until Friday afternoon. Then I would go home and be home for a couple days and go right back. Because unlike, you know, cancer in this day and age, cancer before the late 2000s had you actually spending your life in the hospital. You didn't get a life outside of your cancer treatments and chemo. So I grew up in the hospital. The nurses and doctors became my family. I remember one particular Halloween there where I had to get my very first PICC line. And it was so creepy because I wasn't aware that it was Halloween. And so when I went to get the PICC line, my doctor was dressed like a mad scientist and my nurse was dressed like a clown. And the last thing that you want as a young person who's about to get stabbed is someone just like a mad scientist stabbing you in the arm with a needle. So needless to say, that was not a pleasant experience for me, but it was one that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life. So I got treatment for about 4 years. I went into remission when I was 9. So the better part of my first in second and third grade schooling years were spent in the hospital as an inpatient. Fourth grade was better because I was getting ready. I was kind of getting ready to go into remission by the time the fourth grade came around, and I didn't have to go to the hospital as much. So fourth grade was when I really was able to kind of start getting a life and making friends, and I could participate in recess and all those things that you take for granted as a kid until you can't do them. Like, I couldn't play when we, you know, did activities inside the gym at school. I couldn't participate in recess. Like, everything was too dangerous for me because of my medical condition. And so when I finally went into remission after all those years, then I, you know, was in school one day and I couldn't read something on the board. And so my teacher had me come up to the board, and it was a projector, if that indicates that I'm 30 now. Like, we had projectors back then. And I couldn't read what was on the projector. So she was like, come closer to the projector and then try. So I tried again. I still couldn't read it. She thought I was faking. But the reality of the situation was, first, why would I fake that? Like, that doesn't make any sense. And for a teacher, it was like, maybe she doesn't know the answer. And then I got home and we had to pull out this paper, because after I went into remission, they gave me a piece of paper that basically says, these are all the things that could happen to you after you have cancer. So you could have different skin spots from the chemo and radiation. You could have like low vision. You can have seizures. You could have all kinds of things that happen to you after you have had cancer. And one of them is actually vision loss. So then I got taken to an optometrist, and the optometrist says, oh, well, her cataracts came back and it looks like they've developed into glaucoma. And that was the first time I ever heard even the word cataracts, or that I had such a thing. And so I was thinking it had something to do with my cancer. So I was freaking out. And then it turned out to be an eye condition. So I went from years of chemo and radiation to what would turn out to be a lifetime of eye surgery and just stress about if I'm going to go blind, and if so, when, and how can we handle that? And in the midst of all of those things happening, my grandfather and my mother were fighting with each other over custody of me. My mom wanted me to come live with her because I'm her daughter. And by this time, she was living in Arkansas. And my grandfather wanted me to stay with him. I mean, it's my belief at this point that there was a part of him that did love me, but he was also getting money from our government for having me live there. He was getting my Social Security benefits. And so because he was getting these benefits, he was able to go into semi-retirement early. And he pretty much would work like part-time and then golf and things like that. So it wasn't like he wanted me to live with him. And he and his second wife, who he was married to during, you know, the time of me having cancer and stuff, went as far as to say that my mom was an unfit mother and that they were, you know, wanting to keep me for my benefit. So then we had to go to court and deal with all of that. And so it got really crazy, because eventually the court was like, if you're so worried about her, why don't you want her brothers? Because, you know, I said earlier, I have an older brother, but I also have a younger brother. And they were both living with my mom. And so the judge says, well, if you're so worried about her well-being, and that's your reason for wanting her to live with you, why aren't you more concerned about her brothers and making sure her brothers are okay? And yeah. So that kind of false bit of concern is actually what led him to losing in court. He didn't help himself by trying to be the concerned grandfather. So that was kind of my life before, essentially up until age 10, I was doing cancer, like dealing with cancer and going back and forth. And then from ages like 10 to 15, was the custody and the court battles. And that, it was very consistent between ages 12, between ages 13 and 15. But 10 and 15 were really wild because we were trying to understand my glaucoma diagnosis. And my mom was, you know, had just moved to Arkansas. And so, but my grandmother and I still had family here, so it was okay. It wasn't really until my grandmother moved to Arkansas when it got really crazy, because then I was pretty much alone. You know, I didn't really have any family here. I didn't have a lot of friends. And there was even a time when my grandfather told my mom, like, oh, well, she can go live with you. But then he changed his mind when he realized me living with her means that my benefits live with her too.
Yeah.
So growing up like that was really, really stressful. And then, contrary to what people believe, once you go into remission after having cancer, you're not just suddenly cured. You know, you still have to deal with how that cancer affected you as a child. So as an adult, I'm very immunocompromised. I still have a lot of health things that come up randomly. I've had many surgeries in my lifetime, like over 70 between having cancer and the glaucoma.
70 is a lot.
Yes. between having cancer and the glaucoma diagnosis. I mean, eye surgeries take up a significant chunk of those surgeries, but also, I had a lot of surgeries when I was having chemo and radiation. And then I've had multiple bowel obstructions and hernia repairs and things like that that come from like all the scar tissue that builds up in my body. And
so, yeah, no, so that's so much, so many events and so intricate, so many things were going on. I have so many sort of questions as you were going through that. To just know more about each experience. And there's a couple that come to mind first. And I was just also add, like, it makes sense to me, like you're saying, the afterwards, like even though you're in remission and the cancer's gone, it's like that happened during your stages of growth as a child. So your body's still building, and then that's going to have affected everything further on in the line. Whereas I imagine if you're an adult in your 30s and that happens, the recovery is a lot faster because it's not still growing, say, in the same way. But I just wanted to know as well, your mother got custody and stuff, but do you still have a good relationship with your grandfather or with your mother now that you're later in life?
So my grandfather passed last year in June, and it was hard for me that he passed. Not because we had a good relationship, because we never really had a good relationship after everything was said and done. But honestly, we also never really had a good relationship before that, too. Yeah. And for me, that's a big part of it. Like, I tried, you know, I would call him on his birthday. I would try to keep him in touch with what I was doing in my life. I remember when I was a sophomore in high school, I got sponsored on a trip to Washington, D.C. Someone sponsored my trip, so I didn't have to pay that much money to go. All I really had to do was like bring my spending money and stuff like that. So at one point, around his birthday was coming up, because the trip took place in March, and his birthday was in February. So when I called him in February to tell him, you know, happy birthday and see how he was doing, he was asking me what was going on in my life. Because after the custody battle took place, I still had to check in with the courts every 6 months for like 18 months so that they made sure I transitioned okay and I wasn't being neglected and all of that. So anytime I would call my grandfather, the first thing that he would want to do was ask, like, oh, well, what are you doing? Are you being taken care of and everything? So when I told him about DC, he says, well, you know, if you were staying in Indiana, you could have still gone to D.C. And I was like, first of all, I didn't even know that was a thing I wanted to do. But second of all, can you just be happy for me? Like, that was my issue with my grandfather, is that he never really had the ability to be happy for other people. When he passed and I went to the funeral, it was really cathartic for me to see his growth. Because even though I never personally got to see it, there were like pictures of him volunteering at this church where we had this funeral service and all kinds of stuff. And I can honestly say that's not the grandfather I ever knew. So to be able to see that he experienced some growth, even though I saw it after he died, that was really good for me. But our relationship was just never the same after that. Like, I always felt like he wanted to be rewarded for keeping me away from my family. Because he really believed that he was doing a favor, but he didn't realize how much trauma I was dealing with in his house. Like, his second wife was cruel. She was a very, very cruel woman. And she treated me like I was the ugly stepchild. And so she would use the money that they would get for taking care of me, and she would go buy her kids, her two sons, really nice things and pamper them. And then she would go to a Goodwill or a thrift store and buy things for me secondhand, which I can appreciate secondhand things as much as the next person. And so that's not the issue. The issue was she would make this whole big deal about how she's taking care of me and how inconvenient it was. And at the time, I had no idea they were getting money for me. So I would be basically told regularly how much of a burden I was, you know, financially and medically and all that stuff. And then they were getting money for me. And my mom, I was on my mom's insurance, and I also was receiving Medicaid from the state, so they weren't really having to pay for me. You know, since I had to grow up believing that I just was unwanted was a big deal.
Yeah, it's
on the flip side of
pressure, yeah.
Yeah. As far as my relationship with my mom goes, though, it's interesting because we didn't really find a groove with one another until after we lived together. Or actually, until after I moved out as an adult. The reason is because my mother, she was always a single parent. And so she dealt with single parent struggles that I had never experienced. So, for example, there was a day when our power was disconnected for, you know, overnight or something. And I was living in a two-income household, so I had never experienced that before, not having power. You know, so it was interesting because I had to transition my relationship from my mom, from being the person I saw who brought me gifts on the weekend, you know, when I saw her for a few days, to actually seeing her behind the scenes as a parent and what that looks like. And then I had to also, at the same time, get to know my brothers. So it was interesting because there were things where I felt like my mom kind of failed me when it came to being a parent and, you know, her ability to provide for me. But as I got to know her, I had a better understanding of it. So, you know, my mom and I are pretty close. There was a period of time where, again, we had to figure each other out, you know, and spread out our relationship as mother and daughter. But once we ironed that out, I mean, our relationship has been very, very good. And when you grow up like me with all the health things and stuff, my mom, for the most part, has been the only person I could genuinely rely on. Ever since I lived with her, anytime I had a health issue or crisis, she was always there. My grandfather really had no issue or took no issue with getting me admitted to the hospital and then being like, okay, I'll be back to check on you tomorrow, you know? Mm. Whereas my mom, once they admitted me, would stay there until she couldn't stay anymore. And then she'd be like, okay, I got to go home and eat and get clothes. And then I'll be back in 4 or 5 hours, you know?
Yeah, totally different level of nurture.
Yes. So growing up like that was interesting because I tell people jokingly, but also seriously, like I didn't get hugged enough as a child because I grew up in a house where I wasn't really acknowledged as a person deserving of love and hugs. And then when you transfer that over to me living with my mom as a teenager, for her, it was probably difficult to get to know me too, because she didn't know me as her teenage daughter. She knew me as the 5-year-old little girl she left at her dad's house, you know, a decade prior. So it was interesting, but definitely my relationship with my mom has been very good over the years.
Oh, nice. And yeah, I really want to get into how you came to be in the position you are now where you're talking about it. But first, I just want to share a little story with you and then ask another question. When I was about, I'm trying to think how old was I, I remember I had a part-time job. So I must have been about 16 years old. I had college and a job, and I got some chemicals in my eyes and it burnt off like the front layer of my eyes. And I lost my vision, went to the hospital. And for like 2 weeks, I couldn't see anything. And then it took like a month for my vision to come back. But during especially the first 2 weeks, it wasn't clear whether I would ever see again. And it was such a bizarre experience to lose your sight, but also the fear and the stress of thinking that you're going to lose it. So I'm curious, with your side of when you started to get these vision issues and go through all them problems, what gave you the strength? Because it went on and it's still gone on to this time. What gave you strength during these times to just carry on living and persevering and keeping your willpower?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that. And you're the first person to ever ask me that in this context. And what I'll say is the fear of dying. There have been a lot of times in my life where I felt like I would be better off dead, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, why should I have to deal with all of these things, back-to-back-to-back issues? And I'm just a young girl in the grand scheme of things who never, you know, set out to hurt people, who's already had a really long, traumatic life because of having cancer and has a family that can't get along. And so I never understood why. On the flip side of that, I also grew up being one of those people who only prayed when I needed something from God. So when I knew I had to have surgery, then all of a sudden I would flip the script and start praying and everything because I knew I didn't want to die. And then when I didn't have to have surgery or was all clear, I would go back to not necessarily, it wasn't that I gave up on my religion. I just wasn't devout the way that I am when I was, you know, going into the hospital.
Yeah.
And so in 2017, actually, I went through a situation medically where I was very sick and no one knew what was wrong with me. A year prior, I had just had a major surgery. So we were all thinking like, oh, well, maybe it's something from the surgery that you had last year. And the surgeon was like, no, she seems fine. I went to a bunch of doctors. I was having a lot of pain, a lot of vomiting. It was miserable. And during that time, I rediscovered my faith. And it ended up being kind of perfect because I spent a lot of that year and a lot of the following year talking to my grandmother, who, you know, was the matriarch of our family. But she had a spiritual relationship with God that I couldn't even put into words. So she is someone who we would all go to when we knew we were veering off of our designated road, or when we needed to understand something that we read in the Bible, or, you know, anything. My grandma was always that go-to for us. And so that last year and a half, from January 2017 to about June 2018, I grew very close to my grandmother. And then she passed in November of 2018. So for me, it was like a blessing to be able to have that time with my grandmother for that last year and a half. But honestly, it was just not wanting to die that made me be able to live. And I believed that one day that would no longer be my lot in life. Like one day I would have a family that really loved me and I would have siblings that truly appreciated me. And that was when I was determined, even if I had to build a family of my own, I was going to have a family who loved each other and accepted each other without it always being a problem.
Yeah. And it's really interesting when you said with the faith as well, because what happened, like I had a lot, I don't know how much you know of my story, if you've seen much of my content, but my childhood was really traumatic, totally different childhood to yours. As like I say, everyone's so unique, but I can really relate to certain experiences. When I was young, my mom was a single mom and parents split. My dad did see me on weekends, but my mother was developing schizophrenia that was getting severely severe. And by the time I was like 7, 8, her mental illness was so bad that she was unable to manage money to clean, to look after me and my brother. And we would hide as much as we could from my dad on the weekend because we wanted to enjoy that time with him and forget about our week. But we could go days without food, living in filth, you know, and just having to see very bizarre and strange events happening with our mum that just really heightened my awareness without me realizing, because I became very analytical, looking at everything and looking at other people and their relationships with parents and everything I didn't have, I could see. Yeah. And it was like, going through that, but it made me question life itself because I was going through so much pain and suffering in my experience that I was questioning, what's the point of life? Like, why, if I was to end this life, I won't suffer. So, like, my first suicidal thought started at about 7 because I was just like, I can't take this. And I remember praying and praying, and I don't come from a really strong religious background, but same as you, it was my nan. She was really religious, and she was one that would make us go to church and do things. But as she got older and then she passed, like that just disappeared. And well, I used to pray and I felt like I wasn't getting answers. I felt like I wasn't getting anything from it. So it made me then question religion and question everyone else's beliefs. And then it was just like resilience and strength. Like you're saying, I was just like, you know what? One day when I fix everything, I will feel good. I will feel like every life sorting it out. And then like 20 years later, in 2015, life just fell apart even more. All my stresses, all my problems continued throughout all them years. Depression and suicidal issues popping up, and in that year, like, everything got worse. My mum was trying to commit suicide every single month for 7 months. My partner Danielle had a cardiac arrest and dropped dead and was brought back to life and put in a wheelchair and told now I'm her full-time carer as well. And I just couldn't take the suffering. I was like, I'm questioning life, what's the point? But something within me sparked this fight to just persevere and like, do you know what? I'm going to find a way to find some form of love and joy within regardless of what's happening in my world. And that sent me on a new path. And within that couple of years, like, faith entered my life again. And I've tried to explain to people, it's not a faith that I get from any particular religion. They all have it within them. I said, but it's a faith in life itself. Yeah. And, you know, in that presence of there's a God, there's a flow. And I became very, it's not pleased, like, and not satisfied, but very comfortable in the flow of life. And it's like, I'm just going to be the best loving, kind, compassionate person I can be and develop that. And whatever happens, happens. That's not my control anymore. And they said when COVID kicked off, I was like, it's clearly not my control. You know, it's like that's all, the whole world's shutting down. That's not within my grasp. I can't fix every problem. But what I can maintain in how I feel within is my problem. And that sent me on a new path. And like I said, I'm refinding faith and all them issues cleared. Like there's no suicide. There's no depression. There's no, none of these issues that I suffered for so long. And I believe that faith is such a big part of that. And that process that so many I see missing. So no, I'm really happy to hear how that developed in your life and how that changed. I'm going to go back to your childhood because like that was so traumatic and you had such a intense experience from so long. What I always ask my guests is like what their first ambition or dream or something was to become. And for most people, they might have had some sort of trauma, but yours was really prolonged. But do you remember like, when you was really a little kid, like the first thing you're like, oh, I want to be a nurse or I want to be this or I want to do that. Do you remember your first dream?
So I actually had a few of them. So I'll give you a couple that still resonate with me to this day. And these answers will actually tell you a lot about who I am as a person. So when I was really young, I was still elementary school age. I wanted to be an ice cream truck driver. Because, you know, when you're going through the summer and you're a kid, one of the best moments in the world is when the ice cream truck comes through your neighborhood. No matter what you're going through, how bad your day is, if you could get 50 cents from somebody so that you could get something from the ice cream truck, that just made everything better. And so growing up, I always wanted to be the person that people, the other people could rely on to make things better. So I did want to drive an ice cream truck. There was also a time during all of the custody stuff where I wanted to be a guardian ad litem. And a guardian ad litem is a licensed social worker. Sometimes they're an actual lawyer, but mostly they're licensed social workers whose job it is to speak on behalf of a child during any court proceedings. So in my case, it was during a custody battle, but sometimes it's with domestic abuse, sexual assault, anything like that. They're hired to speak on behalf of the child and make sure that the child is being adequately represented. And so I had a guardian ad litem, and he was the first person in my entire life. Now, keep in mind, I met him, I probably was 14 or 13 by the time I met him. And he was the first person in my life who made me feel like I had a voice. He sat down and said, "Michelle, what do you want? You know, do you want to live with your mom? And if so, why? Do you want to stay live with your grandfather? If so, why? You know, if you don't want to live with either of them, why?" And he actually made me feel like I was being heard. And I wanted to give that to other children, because as traumatic as my childhood was, the worst thing about my childhood was feeling like I never was heard. And that carried on into adulthood. You know, I tell people that 2021 is when I truly realized the power of my own voice. And that was when I truly realized that when I speak, people listen and they want to hear what I have to say. But I was 29 last year. You know, you shouldn't go into your 30s with the belief that no one respects your opinion or no one wants to ever hear what you have to say. And I almost did that. I almost entered into my 30s believing that no one respected my opinion and no one wanted to hear me. So those are the two jobs that I wanted to do, because I wanted to bring happiness to people, but I also wanted to make sure they wanted to be heard.
Yeah, no, it's really powerful. And I remember you saying right at the beginning, like, even when your first pain started, that your grandfather was just like, "No, she just wants attention. Like, that's, it's not true that you're a liar." And them first things from whoever our parent figure is at that time can put such a strong imprint on how we think we need to behave to be accepted. You know, absolutely. So for someone to call you basically a liar from the beginning will make you very quickly think, well, if I can't say my truth, I can't speak for myself, I can't be honest, you know, because if I be honest, I'm called the liar. And who wants to be called a liar? So it's to end up, and then you don't want to lie either. So you end up just becoming silent. You know, and I've seen that with quite a lot of people. And they say, and even it happens to people even into their 50s, their 60s, their 70s, some people go to their deathbed never sharing their voice because they never recognize that value that they have, that worth they have. And that's a big part of what I share online to people, is what helped me find my worth, what helped me find my value, my voice. And just so someone else might recognize how beautiful and amazing they are, like you, you're beautiful and amazing for sharing. It's such a, I appreciate it. And I'm so grateful for you telling me your life and your story. I truly am. And I want to know, so you said that was only 2021, which is only last year. So that's really recent. What was your first steps in sharing your voice?
My first steps in sharing my voice happened a couple of different. I would say one of the pinnacles for me was back in 2014. I participated in a program called Independence Job Corps. And Job Corps here is like a training institute. So you can go there and you can get like a culinary certificate, automotives, like a technical school, like a trade school.
Okay.
So that, you know, you kind of understand where I'm going with this. So I chose office administration as my trade. And because typically when people go there, they've had experiences where they've been kicked out of traditional schooling, or they dropped out because of, you know, other circumstances or pregnancies or what have you. So it was interesting because I got there and it didn't take long of me being there for people to really start seeing me, like past my visual impairment or anything like that. People really saw me. And because they saw me, they wanted me to do things and participate in things. And I got nominated for a lot of leadership roles while I was there. And that was a big deal to me because I was only there for 6 months. Traditionally, you can participate in the program from 6 months to 2 years. And a lot of people, it takes them the entire 2 years. But within 6 months, I was able to, you know, go there, get what I needed from the program and get out. And then the people whose lives I touched were a big deal. But the people who touched me were even a bigger deal. Because there were so many people there saying, like, Michelle, this is your first step to doing whatever you want to do. You can do it. You know, this is just step one. And after I left there, it wasn't that long before I got my first real tax deductible, good paying job. And then I got a lot of respect from my employer. And, you know, through it all, people continued to ask me. Sometimes it was every day, like, how do you do your job? Because at my job, I was the first person that they hired who needed the kind of adaptations that I needed and the kind of accommodations. So people would come to my desk and be like, how can you see that? Or how can you do this, that, or the other? And that's so cool. And so it was interesting to be stared at all the time. But it wasn't, you know, it took me a while to realize people weren't being malicious. Like, they genuinely wanted to know how I did it and what motivated me to keep doing it. And like, one woman came and was like, I have a perfectly capable son who doesn't need any of this, and I can't get him to work. And you had to come to work and work almost twice as hard as the rest of us. And you come every day with a smile. And that was when I first started realizing that I matter and my voice matters. But even more than that, I started realizing that even when I think people don't see me, they see me. And that was like the biggest turning point for me, was knowing that even when I feel like I'm not being seen or heard, there's somebody out here who says, you know what, I see you and I hear you, even if it's only one person at a time.
Yeah, and you're getting your first real, like you said again, acknowledgement and encouragement during that process, and like a tick box in your value that you're seeing, actually, do you know what? I'm not the person that I've been told most of my life who I am, and I'm not a burden, you know, and that I've actually got a use and a function. And like you said, you did that. It's impressive that you did it. And again, like, you'd say I was just doing it like someone else would, but you did it with limitations that others don't experience. But in a sort of, I don't know how you'd measure it, like, how is your sight now? So how would you describe how you see? Like, how limited is it?
So that's hard. It's hard to describe it to someone who's not here for like physical demonstration. But the best thing I can tell you is at this point, my vision is like looking through haze. Like, you know how you get up and it's like a foggy day outside, and you can see like the shapes and stuff through the fog, but you can't really make out what you're seeing.
Yeah.
My vision is basically like maybe a half step up from that. There's times where I have a little more clarity than just fog all the time. But for the most part, that's where I am with things. Like I can see, for example, if I have a pink shirt, I can see the shirt and I might be able to see the letters on the shirt, but it'll be blurry to the effect of not being able to read the shirt.
So you can see colors and shades and sort of abstract patterns of the outlines of things, but with a real blur.
Yes. Like it's almost backward. Like the closer it is, it's almost more blurry. But then if it's too far away, I can't see it. So you have to get it, you know, just right. I have Goldilocks and the Three Bears vision. You know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, and sometimes it's just right.
Okay. Yeah, because it was only maybe a month or so ago, maybe 2 months now. I go on an app called Green Room. I'm not sure if you heard of it. It's like a Spotify live audio chat room. Yes. And I was on there and I was talking. These two girls came in and they're just rambling on talking. And I just jump into a conversation and we're just having a conversation, sharing like what we're up to in the world. And I was asking them what they do and stuff. And then this like robot voice started speaking. And I was like, oh, what's going on? What happened? And they're like, oh, sorry about that. They said, we're both blind. And I was like, oh, I had no idea. And I said, so what's the robot? And they said, oh, that's how we see. They said their phone talks to them and like describes things to them. And then they gave me an example. And it was like really fascinating for me, like, because it was like swipe up and then wait for a vibration, swipe left so they could know whereabouts their finger was on the screen. They had it set to a ridiculous speed where they're so used to it and they can work so well with it. I was like, I couldn't follow that because that was just too fast.
And it's interesting because people have asked me my entire life, well, how much can you see? And for the longest time, you know, that phrase would offend me so much. People would say, how much can you see? How many fingers am I holding up? You know, do you see that over there? Or if you remember, I haven't told this story in a long time. So it'll be like exclusively for you because it's not even in the book.
Thank you very much.
I remember there was a time when I was traveling in the car with my grandfather, his wife, his two kids, and a couple of their friends. And we're driving through this dark, it was like sunset-ish, so it was semi-dark, isolated stretch of road that had like lots of farms everywhere, like dotted all over the place. And so the guys in the car decide that they're gonna play a trick on me by everyone starts looking out the window and seeing like a herd of cows or something, and I wanted to be a part of it. So everyone was like, Michelle, do you see it? And then I was like, yeah, I see it, but I didn't actually see it, right? So then I remember getting like harassed for like the next 3 days by my uncles and their friends, and they would just run up to me like, Michelle, do you see it, and then laugh and walk away because there was really nothing there to see. And so how much can I see? For me, I realize that my vision goes so far past just what are you pointing at or how many fingers are you holding up. My ability to see things goes to who do I see you as character-wise? And how does my view of you shape our interactions? Or what kind of person do I think that you are? And what kind of person am I based on how I see myself? So my book answers all of those questions for me. And that's, you know, kind of what I want people to get out of it is, like, I understand the need and the desire to try to become someone that you're not so that you don't feel so isolated and alone because of circumstances that are out of your control. In 2020, an acquaintance of mine committed suicide because she was having trouble dealing with her own health struggles and her, you know, things that were plaguing her in her life. And that was when I was like, you know what? It's time for me to really put my foot down and stop procrastinating and write this book. Because people need to know that they're not alone and that there are other people struggling and other people, you know, just waiting for an opportunity just like you are. And I realized, though, in order to do that, I had to be 100% honest about who I am, who I was, and who I want to be. And I knew that was the only way I would be successful at writing a book. So it took a long time because I tried very hard to spare people's feelings. And then I realized if I keep trying to spare people's feelings, people will not see me in my writing. And so then I stopped trying to spare people's feelings. And then I still was so scared about what other people would think. So once I got over that part, and then I just wrote. And I just said, you know what, this is how I feel about all of these things. And it's finally time I get them on paper. And then I started focusing on the good. You know, I realized that I used to live a life where good things were few and far between for me. And I used to deal with so much depression and anxiety because things would be so bad for so long. And then something good would happen, and then it would just slip out of my fingers. And I remember telling my fiance a couple of months ago, I said, you know what, honey? It's so crazy because I'm finally at a point in life where I can stop waiting for the other shoe to drop. But when good things would happen, I would freak out because I would always expect them to end quickly. And so it took a while for me to get to a point where I'm just like, you know, whatever happens will happen. I'm finally at a point in my life where I don't hold on to that fear and that negativity. And I attribute a lot of that to my book because, you know, I grew up in a world where when good things happened, bad things followed immediately. Like you couldn't even enjoy the good thing because the bad thing was always right there waiting to sneak up on you. And so once I kind of got out of my head and I got over that, I started really seeing things for what they were. And I started really understanding that my depression and my anxiety was a lot of why bad things continued to happen. Because I personally could never really get over it. It was just always, I was always waiting for bad stuff to happen. I always would count myself out and, you know, like I would set myself up for failure. And I wanted people to know, you know, the way I stopped doing that was by really getting out here and telling my story. But even more than that, there are other people in the world who will fail with you. Like I want how much can I see? I want the book to positively impact people's lives. But I also want it to be a movement. I want people really to know I started a Facebook group that is slowly growing. I started it in late February. And I'm finally at 400 members. And that was really exciting. But it's a place where I encourage people to go. And, you know, I say all the time to people, if you can't tell your truth anywhere else, you can tell your truth with me, whether you're telling it in my Facebook group, whether you're calling me on the phone, sending me an email. Like I want people to know that any space where I am is a space where you're safe being 100% you. And it's something I never got growing up. And so I want to give it to other people who may have never gotten it as well.
Oh, that's so nice. And for those listening, there's two things I want to know. I want to know the story of how you met your fiance and a little about your relationship, but also where can someone find your book? Where can they go to read it?
So my book right now is available on Amazon Kindle. I think, don't quote me on this, but I think you can go to amazon.kindle.uk. to order it, or However, you know, you guys use Kindle overseas, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Amazon.kindle.uk, and look for How Much Can I See? Or if you open your Amazon app and type in How Much Can I See? Or even if you type in my author name, M.L. Farrell, then my book information in my author page will pull up. And then you can even follow my author page to get information about what I'm doing and, you know, new releases. So about my fiance, he and I met last year on the Clubhouse app, actually. And we found out that he and I know similar people. We had some people in common that we knew. So we weren't as far removed from each other as I initially thought we were going to be. And it was interesting because our love story isn't... Some people think it's romantic, but really it's just two people about to be 30 trying to figure out their place in life. So I pursued him. I liked him, but it was funny because he didn't like me. And it wasn't one of those, like, oh, he doesn't like you, like, romantic comedy type situations. He was, like, mean to me, and I didn't know why he didn't like me, and that bothered me. And normally it doesn't. Like, I'm at a point in life, especially after actually going to see a therapist and really working on me, where people not liking me, it's just like, well, whatever, that's your loss. But with him, yeah, it was different. I was like, why don't you like me? And so finally I reached out to him, I DM'd him, and I said, you know what? I want to know why you don't like me. It's not fair. I didn't do anything to you. You don't like me. He was like, I like you just fine. I was like, no, you don't. Like, you treat me like I'm just one of these random groupies that chase all over you. That's not okay. So then he ended up giving me his number and we started talking. And then we realized that we really liked each other, but he was getting out of a long relationship. He and his ex had been together for 5 years and their relationship ended. And so when we first started talking, I told him, I was like, you know, I'm a really good judge of people and I can tell that you have some healing to do before I can even think about us trying to be together. And he was like, no, I'm fine, whatever. And I was like, okay, well, but you're not. And so eventually he realized that he wasn't fine too. And so he needed some time to work on himself. And he told me, like, during the time that he spent working on himself, he realized, like, I really miss her a lot. And, but he knew that he had to really work for it because when he worked on himself, he ghosted me and just stopped talking to me. And so when he came back around, I was like, well, you know, I forgive you, but you have to earn it because I'm not just going to be one of these stupid girls out here forgiving dudes who treat them the way that you treated me. And so he apologized and he did his penance. And then one day we started talking every day and then it just continued. When my health started getting really bad, so he's from Jersey. He's from New Jersey. And when my health started getting really bad, we had already had a visit planned. He was going to come in September. But then he was like, I'm going to come in August because you're going to have surgery and I don't want you to be alone. So he came in August and then he just never left. We spent that time really talking and getting to know each other. And then in November, he proposed. We went out and for like a couple of weeks prior to the proposal, we were looking for a dog. But when after I had surgery in August, in October, I ended up spending about 10 days in the hospital. And one of those days I was in the hospital, he looks at me and says, when you get out of the hospital, I'm putting a ring on your finger. And I was like, oh, okay, that's so sweet. But I was, you know, like, miserably sick and kind of in a drug stupor. Yeah. So I believed him, but didn't at the same time. And then, you know, when I got out of the hospital, my best friend came to visit and he asks her, like, I want to buy Michelle a ring. Can you take me to help me pick it out? And so they went ring shopping for me together, and it's one of my favorite memories. So my next book is going to be called, we're still working on the title, but it's going to be about he and I finding each other and falling in love during a pandemic and the different experiences we've had in relationships and how those experiences, you know, led us to each other and led us to being the kind of partner that we want for one another.
Oh, nice. It's nice. So beautiful. And you're on your, like you said earlier about, you know, that you're just going to, you want that connection, that family, and to have that value. And I'm really, not impressed is a word. It's just feel good for you. It's not even proud. I'm not sure what the word is, but it's the fact that you were stayed your authentic true self during that, like you said, when he's ghosted you and when that, and you just knew your own, that takes a certain amount of courage. You know, that takes a lot of self-worth, self-respect, self-value to be able to stand that. Like you said, there's a lot of people out there when they feel someone treats them a certain way, they can cave in just to feel that they need to be needed. They need to be secure. And it seems that you didn't have that in that time. And that made the relationship stronger in the end.
It did. But, you know, earlier you asked me about what got me through some of the hard times I went through. And, you know, at that time in my life, it definitely was praying. Like I said, even though I was a bad Christian, because I only prayed when I needed something from God. However, I can say now, you know, in life, I went to therapy for a few years. I was really, really depressed. My grandmother passed in the fall of 2018, but right before she passed, I had a miscarriage, and my 5-year relationship had just ended. And so then it ends, and then I find out that I'm pregnant. And then a few months after my grandmother passes, my dog that I had from age 13, she died a few days after my birthday. And then a few months later, my ex's brother, who became like a brother to me during our relationship, died. And so I dealt with a lot of things that brought me a lot of distress. And then in the fall of 2019, I started losing more vision. Luckily, at that time, I was already in therapy. But I was having days where it was really difficult for me to even wake up and start the day. So to have someone, you know, really encourage me to figure out, like, what's hurting you and how can you heal from that? That was part of the reason, you know, my book turned out how it did. Like, there's parts of my book that will make you laugh and cry and everything in between because I'm so honest about it. Like, I'm honest about my depression. I'm honest about any kind of suicidal thoughts I had. I'm honest about the way people treated me and how I treated them in return. So, you know, fast forward to me no longer being in therapy and my book being finished and having a love that I'm proud of, you know, that was a combination of like hard work and also knowing what's too much for me and that it's okay to say that. I learned that it's okay to say, you know what, this is too much and I'm not dealing with this. So when he did disappear from my life for a period of time and he came back, I had already had my conversation with myself about, is this going to be too much for me? And if not, how can I handle it in a way that doesn't set me back? Because so often we as individuals allow other people to influence us in a way that causes us to act out of character. And just because I was in love didn't mean I didn't, you know, that I wanted to start acting out of character or changing who I was. So while we weren't talking, I focused on determining, like, can I still be the person he knew me to be? Or will this hurt cause a permanent problem in our relationship? And I tell people nowadays, you know, one of the things I took from therapy that I use every single day is acting with intention. I look at situations or people or anything, and I say, you know what? What is my intention? So what I mean by that, for example, is when I contacted you, my intention was to get on your podcast. And I said, hey, this is what I would like to do if you're interested. And this is the way to go about contacting me if you're interested. And so many people don't live that way. So with my situation with my fiance, so many people would have, you know, their intention would have strictly been to hurt him the way that they were hurt. And I'm just not that person. Like, I always have told him, like, I want to love you in a way that you never experienced because you deserve to be loved.
Oh, nice.
And we've grown a lot together. You know, my ability to open up with him about my childhood and to know that I can feel comfortable doing so, and his ability to be vulnerable with me. Being together with him has allowed me to grow in ways I never thought I could grow.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I love hearing people's relationship stories, especially when, like I said, there's an authenticity there. There's wanting each other to grow, like you said, and you want to give them more love than they've ever experienced. Like, it's really powerful. And I actually had a guest before, and they was in a really toxic relationship that went for like 10 years of abuse. And she described it as being, she said they were like two plants in one plant pot, and they were just strangling each other's roots, and neither one of them could grow. And they said it just became so horrible. But she goes, now that person, even though they're not together, many years later, is like one of her best friends, and she even calls him her teacher, because she learned so much from that on actually how important it is in a new relationship. Now she's got a child with someone else and she's with them, to allow each other to grow and not to have fear that they will grow apart, but that growth and change is good. And I had it only yesterday, it's not out yet, a relationship coach, and he's been in a 20-year relationship, and he goes I've only been married once, he goes, but I'm married to multiple different people, he goes, because during that 20 years, he goes, we've both grown so much, he goes, it's like you're marrying someone else every few years, he goes, because you're always growing together. And he goes, and you don't hold the person to their past and how they was. He goes, but you appreciate them in the moment they're in, and also the growth and the change that they've had. So it's beautiful to hear how your relationship's developing. And no, I truly appreciate you sharing that.
I mean, he's incredible. He has motivated me and encouraged me so much on my book journey. Like, he's probably my number one fan after our son. Who's a puppy, and he's fantastic. But he encourages me so much, and he'll like remind me, like, don't forget, you need to, you know, you're going to reach out to this person to try to be on their podcast, or, you know, I haven't seen him post about your book in a while. Don't forget to talk about your book. And I come from a relationship where I'm not used to that. Like, my ex was not, our relationship was about him. And our life was about him, and everything was about him. So having a partner who genuinely cares about me and what I'm doing and making sure I'm happy doing it is a huge deal. And then he and I do a podcast together called It Goes Down in the DMs, where we talk openly about our relationship, and we give relationship advice, and we talk to people about how we discovered who we were and what that process looked like for us.
What did you say the podcast was called?
It's called It Goes Down in the DM.
Okay.
And, you know, we've grown a lot from doing that together, and we've learned a lot about each other. We try to learn about each other every single day. And so there's conversations that we have on the podcast. I'm just like, man, I didn't know that that's how you felt about this situation. Or, you know, it's great for us to be having these conversations so we know for the future. And it's very eye-opening. You know, once you get out of a toxic lifestyle and you remove yourself from a toxic situation, then you kind of start to learn what you want your future to look like. And I now know, like, having the partner that I have and growing the life that I'm growing, I know first and foremost, like, I want a house full of laughter and love, which I have an abundance of. And, you know, like I said before, I want to build my own family where I have siblings and a parent that I can rely on, which, you know, I've done. Some of my best friends are like my sisters now, and I can rely on them. My best friend drove here from Jersey back in November because she knew I was in the hospital and I needed her. Showing people, again, the kind of love that I wasn't able to receive. And so when you have a partner that embraces all that you are and encourages you to be all those parts of yourself, because my ex could have never accepted me, you know, motivating people through my own personal life story and sharing my time and my voice with other people and letting them call me, you know, whenever they need to talk. Like, my ex never could have done that. But my fiance is just like, that's fantastic. That's part of who you are. Let's set boundaries so that people aren't calling you at 1 and 2 in the morning or anything like that. So it's been really, it's definitely been a transition to go from having someone who, as long as you were doing for them, they were happy, to having someone who wants to do everything in his power to keep you happy and who encourages a healthy relationship between me and his mother. And I mean, he's literally, if people would have told me growing up that this is what love and sex was supposed to look like, I would have waited to lose my virginity. And I would have really evaluated the people that I now can call exes. Because I didn't realize that it was supposed to be, you know, people go, you go through life with people telling you like, oh, well, sometimes it's hard. And sometimes you have to deal with things like cheating and all that stuff, which sometimes you do. But unfortunately, we live in a time where that has become the societal norm. And so then when you get in a relationship like the one I'm in, you look awestruck because you didn't know that it doesn't have to be emotionally and verbally abusive, and it doesn't have to be toxic, and you don't have to wonder if, you know, you go to bed early, who is he talking to on the phone? Like, all those things that people set you up for were kind of lies. And then you had to stop and think, like, well, that's what they were told. You know, so many women and men were told, oh, well, you know, women get told your man's going to do what he's going to do, and it's your job to just obey. And then men get told, oh, well, these women need a firm hand, or they just need to listen, or you can do whatever you want to them. So when you get in a situation that's healthy, you know, especially for me, because I didn't really have any examples of healthy, solid male role models growing up. So then when I end up in a situation where I'm like, wow, this is really good for me. And I just look confused. Like, sometimes I just look over at him like, I'm so happy that you are a part of my future life chapters.
It's just really beautiful to hear. So happy for you.
Thank you. He accepts me and he encourages me to accept me. And that's my favorite part about it. You know, people so often fall in love and they can't really say, like, this is why I love this person. And there are so many reasons I can say, like, why I love my fiance. But the primary reasons are because he makes me better and because he encourages me to do better. Like, he doesn't just run around going, oh, my fiance wrote a book. He runs around screaming, like, my fiance wrote a book, and you need to buy her a book, and I'm going to buy the book, and I'm going to read the book. Like, he's really someone who I can rely on as a partner.
Yeah, and it sounds like he recognizes your potential as well, which is something that's been, say, ignored through your life and almost ignored in yourself for much of your life because you've been, you know, put in a certain category in a certain way, and there's someone coming along who's actually going, no, do you know what you've done? Yeah, you've done a book. When's your second book out? You know, they know that you've got potential and a life to live.
Well, that, and he also, and I think what people fail to even consider when they're looking for future partners is he will defend me. And I didn't realize how important that was until I started getting, you know, there's been so much of my life even that I've spent in hospitals alone. So then when I get up and I go to a hospital and he's sitting beside me going, you know what, honey, get some rest and I'm going to handle these doctors. And then he makes sure that they give me the medicine I need, and he makes sure, like, don't forget, she's got allergies and she's got this and she's got that. And, you know, I don't have to be my own protector all the time.
Mm.
And I never knew what that was like until he and I got together. And I never knew what I was missing.
Yeah.
Like, people take advocating for themselves such for granted. Because I never, I, when I wasn't with my grandfather, because, you know, like I told you, the hospital we went to was out of the city where we lived. So they couldn't be at the hospital all the time. My mom couldn't be there all the time. So I didn't really have anyone there to advocate for me. So I got so used to advocating for myself. And that turned toxic. Because then you get into situations where you can't really, even if you're in pain, sink into the oblivion offered by the pain meds, because the doctors or nurses are going to come in and check on you or ask you something, and you have to be alert enough to answer or yeah. sign papers or whatever. So he's brought me a kind of love and peace that I don't normally get just by giving me everything I didn't know I was missing.
Oh, that's perfect. I'm afraid I could keep talking to you, to be honest, but we are near the end of the show. I try to keep the shows to like an hour. I think we've done about an hour and 20, hour and 15. But no, I think your book is really, it's really important. Like you said, you got your voice out there, and I really encourage people to go and read it and, you know, and drop some feedback as well. The feedback always helps. So it also helps the author as well as helps the other people find the content.
Yes. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's you know, it's one of the things, it's inspiring and motivating when someone has a voice and puts it out. And I truly, my, whether you call it belief or perception or whatever it is, but to me, I feel everything in life has a polarization in the same way that forwards can't exist if backwards doesn't exist. I feel our life struggles, our life traumas, our life dramas, whatever it is, the experience that we've had that can give us such pain and such suffering always offer us an opportunity at any moment to change into a gift of service. And I think that's exactly what you've done with your experience in your life. And I'm truly blessed to have spoke to you and to have been a part of that, and really do wish you the best for the future.
Thank you so much. You know, thank you so much for having me on your show. I really, really appreciate it. You can find me on all social media platforms at Author ML Farrell. You can order the book on Amazon. Look for How Much Can I See? Again, right now, the Kindle ebook is available for pre-order. And then next Monday, so April 11th, you'll be able to officially order the paperback book for anybody who wants a physical copy of the book in hand. Oh, nice. That'll be available to order on the 11th.
Oh, nice. Oh,
and then I was going to say, and the last thing is, if you want to know more about me or a more personal connection with me on social media, definitely join my group, How Much Can I See? And it's a place where I always am posting motivational stuff, funny things. You can find some worksheets there that I created, and even some audio files of other speaking points that I've done previously. So that's in the group, How Much Can I See?
Nice. And I'll make sure to put all of that in the description as well, so people can just click it and go straight there now and follow. I have just a few short, fun questions I ask every guest at the end of the show. Do you have a moment for them?
Absolutely.
And also, one other thing I was thinking, I had an author on a couple of weeks ago. I'll send you a link to her interview, but in the descriptions, her contacts. Now, she's an author and she's an award. She's won like 75 international awards for books, but she started by... She teaches children with cognitive disabilities. That's her profession. And she made a book to help teach them. And someone said, oh, you should get that book published. And she sent it to a publisher. It got published and won loads of awards. But I think she might be a really good network for you there to maybe speak with her and see where that goes. So I'll send you her links afterwards as well.
Oh, thank you so much. I definitely will reach out to her.
Yeah, and yeah, so the questions, I think I know the answer to this first one because you briefly spoke about it, but if you had to choose one, cat or dog?
Definitely dog. My yellow lab Rufus, he's my dream. Also, I'm allergic to cats, so there's
okay.
That.
Makes it easier. Yeah. What's your favorite color?
I have five, actually. I don't choose any over the other. So my favorite colors are lime green, pink, blue, lavender, and silver. However, my preferred colors to wear clothing-wise are black or blue.
In the simplest form, what excites you and motivates you?
Food.
What does the opposite? What gets you down or drives your energy down?
Rain. I am so scared of thunderstorms. They give me anxiety, and I don't like them. So, you know. But if you want to make me feel better about the rain, just buy me food, and we're good.
Yeah.
I get so excited about food. We went out over the weekend, and I like cheered for my food. I was like, oh my god, yay. So I like clap for it and everything in public, and everyone just looks at me like, yes, we expect this from you.
Nice. What sound or noise do you love?
What sound or noise do I love? Laughter. I nice. Love the sound of laughter, especially like in my vicinity or if I'm a part of it or causing the laughter.
Nice. What sound or noise do you not like so much?
Can we go back to thunder? Still thunder. I don't like thunder, but also I don't like the sound of birds. I'm afraid of birds, and so I cringe a little bit every time I hear a bird chirp.
Okay. What do you love about yourself?
Everything.
Nice. It's a good answer.
I went to a lot of therapy. I love everything about myself now.
What do you love to see in other people?
Authenticity. You know, if you come to me and you're authentically you, whether you're, you know, black, white, or purple, as long as you're being exactly who you are, I love that and respect that about everyone.
Nice. And last question. What do you love about animals? Now, this can be pets or animals in nature. What is your choice?
You know, I love that animals have a hierarchy. Like, I love that we as people know which animals are at the top of the food chain, and animals love that and know that as well. And it's not, and that they know that without the abilities to organize and have wars.
I've had a lot of similar answers, but that's a really interesting one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they really accept their lot in life, you know? And so, given the opportunity, if I could live like an animal for a while, I would, just to see, like, are you born with that kind of acceptance, or do you just instinctively know? You know what I'm saying? Like, I would love to experience that. So, that's what I love about animals. They have a hierarchy, and they know their place.
Oh, nice. Okay, that's the end of the show. Thank you so much for participating, being honest, authentic, and sharing. I truly appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
I know it was early in the day for you, so have a beautiful rest of your day, whatever you get up to. And yeah, best of luck with the book and its progress, and you're going to touch many lives.
Thank you so much. I'll be checking in on you soon to check out your episodes and see how you're doing, because I love this podcast and I love that you had me on. So thank you again so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I don't know if you use Instagram. I put on Instagram some content and update on there, but I'm on YouTube, and the podcast is on pretty much every podcast platform. And new episodes every Wednesday and Sunday. What time zone did you say you are?
Eastern Standard Time.
Eastern, so it's 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Wednesday and Sunday. A new episode goes out.
Awesome. Well, I am in my email. If you check out like my email where my signature is, it has all the links to follow me on stuff. So if you follow me on Instagram, then I can follow you back so that I can check out the stuff that you post on Instagram. But I am on all social media platforms.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Following you on Facebook, but to be honest, I only started Facebook this year, and it's a real foreign platform for me, so I haven't it's something I stayed away from the whole time it's been out. Like, I don't want to go on there. Now I'm trying to share with the world. I've had to start using social media, and that's a really new one for me at the moment.
You know what I think it would like based on your, you know, the kind of platform that you're offering? Is you should start the Selfish Podcast group on Facebook. Yeah. And then, you know, you can invite everybody who you've had on the podcast to join, and then invite them to bring their fan bases to your group. Because that would help you grow. And then it would also offer you like a similar platform, like what I have, where the discussion can kind of continue without you having to monitor it all the time.
I wasn't consistent in the, yeah, but I might have to get back to sorting something like that out.
Well, let me know if you ever need help with anything. I do the social media for myself as an author, and for our podcast, it goes down the DM. So it's not like we don't have like a huge following, but I'm really consistent with it. So if you ever need help with social media, or, you know, you can always like schedule posts too. Just like you can schedule them on Twitter. So like every Sunday night I'll sit down and I'll schedule a whole bunch of posts at least 2 weeks out, so that even if I forget or I'm not consistent with it, I know that there's always going to be content being published on in my pages and groups. So if you ever need help with any of that, just reach out to me and I would be happy to help you.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, I didn't know you could schedule on Facebook, so that's interesting. That will help a lot.
Yep, you sure can. All you have to do is if you have a page, just get the Meta Business Suite app. And then if you do it in the group, you can do it directly in the Facebook app.
Okay. I will do some research and check out.
I hope that you and your partner, Daniel, have a great dinner today.
Yeah.
And we'll talk soon.
Okay. Have a nice day, and say hi to your fiance too.
I will. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Bye. Bye. Thank you so much for being here and listening to The Selfish Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Greenheart, and I appreciate you being here. Don't forget to check out my YouTube channel. Just search Luke Greenheart on YouTube. You'll find me. Check out my website, lukegreenheart.com. Have an amazing day, and stay tuned for more episodes. I'll be interviewing guests on their path of self-development, their path to self, getting to know them in much more intimacy, much more depth, sharing and connecting with all, so we can have a much more blissful, joyful, and productive life together. All right, much love. Have a great day.